Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims will come to order. We have a quorum here. We're missing a few members. They've got other duties they have to fulfill, but welcome to the members here tonight. I appreciate everybody that could get here, and looks like it's a brand new year. So we have some claims that have been held over by the subcommittee from last year coming up. The first one on our committee assignment is the claims against the Department of Natural Resources. Is that correct? Okay. All right. The minutes that have been introduced in your committee chair, can I get a motion to move them?
I would so move the...
Sir, the Representative Quam moves that the April 12th, 2016 minutes be recommended to pass and approved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried, and the minutes have been approved from April 12th, 2016 meeting on the Joint House and Senate Subcommittee on Claims. Rules and procedures.
Yeah, I'll just give a quick update. We don't have any rules or procedures changes, but I will make a quick statement on two claims that are being held over for next session on procedural reasons. The subcommittee received an exoneration claim on March 2nd, 2017. There's a 30-day period that the claimant can seek judicial review. That time period hasn't lapsed yet, so we're holding that over for procedural reasons. In October, we received a claim from Wright and Becker counties dealing with the attorney's fees in litigation with the state auditor. There's separate bills that are moving forward on that, House File 458 and Senate File 1068, and those have been heard in their appropriate committees and are moving forward in the process. The Senate version of the delete everything for the omnibus was just posted today, and that is included in that. So pending that legislation, we'll see if there is a reason to bring it before this subcommittee. So those are just updates on procedural grounds, and then we'll move to, speaking of holdovers, a claim that was heard first 2 years ago, the Dixon claim.
Okay. Thank you, Casey. Is that right?
Oh, no, I'm Jason.
Jason, I'm sorry. I'm looking at two different emails here. Sorry.
Oh, you're good.
The first claim on our agenda that was held over from 2016, welcome, Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Is the claim by Mr. Dean Dixon. We have four testifiers to come on behalf of Mr. Dixon, and if they would come forward to testify, or one, at least one of those four, and Mr. Dixon, that would be appreciative. Thank you. Please come forward and state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Senator. John Peterson appearing with Dean Dixon, to my left. We submitted three affidavits for clarification from Dean's children in support of our claim. Mr. Tom Hansen did come down if there's any necessary testimony to be taken. But I think it behooves, first of all, a quick procedural posture, procedural history as to where we find ourselves. This was submitted by the subcommittee. The subcommittee in 2015 requested Mr. Dixon supplement information to support his claim that he'd made. Mr. Dixon came to me actually last year to request my services. It was recommended that he retain an attorney. Unfortunately, it came shortly before the 2016 hearing. We didn't have enough opportunity to gather the records together for his claim. So we asked for a continuance to today's date, or this year's, I should say, hearing. Unfortunately, Mr. Dixon, we've attempted to comply with the subcommittee's request on documentation for income received during the five-year period. And again, that summary was contained in Mr. Colvin's March 2nd, 2017 letter to Ms. Gersovich. Unfortunately, the only records we could find were the 1981 records, which were submitted The record requests were made to the Internal Revenue Service for the five-year period in question, and Mr. Dixon received a response stating that they could not find the records based upon the time period involved, which is basically 86 or 85 to 89. So that was rejected, and that was submitted to him. So we did a second request. He had to send us a $400 fee for the records. They returned the $400 check with the letter stating they could not find the records, that they could not provide the tax returns. So Mr. Dixon was unable, again, due to length of time, to provide the documentation. He did, however, have a copy of his 1981 tax return, which was submitted. The summary of that...
No aside then.
Yeah. And the 1981...
shows that I didn't do any sod.
And he didn't do any sod for that year. That was just his regular income. So we can't find any records other than the testimony of Mr. Dixon. And I'm not quite sure how much detail you want to get into insofar as the income he had from his testimony. That's why, again, we brought Mr. Hansen to explain. He was an employee of Mr. Dixon during the period in question and can testify as to the operation of the sod field. We submitted, along with our requested submissions by letter on February 27, 2017, records supporting the fact that there was indeed a sod field. There's various references to the fact that there may have been a sod field, but there's questioning as to whether or not there was a functioning sod field during the periods Mr. Dixon's claimed.
81, you say? Oh, I was in the sod
field. Yeah. But in any respect, I'm sorry.
Mr. Peterson, counsel would just like to a brief touch base here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it may be helpful just to speak quickly about procedurally where this claim was 2 years ago and where we're at with it now. The claim was here 2 years ago. There was about almost an hour worth of testimony as to what the field conditions were, what the causations were. At that time, there was a request from the members of the subcommittee for the tax information and a couple of record requests to the DNR regarding sort of the prior conditions of that and how much of the initial claim was a claim that the DNR in ordering Mr. Dixon to fill the ditch that was dug caused a reflooding, if not original flooding, of this sod farm. The DNR presented some additional information as well, going back, and perhaps the DNR can speak to the documentation that they provided, which goes back further prior to the actual incidents leading up to the order to fill the ditch. Because I think at this point, from where the testimony left off 2 years ago, I think that might shed a fair amount of light on the conditions that existed prior to the restoration order.
Mr. Peterson, can you take it from that point from last year, or weren't you involved with this case at that point?
I was not involved at that point, so I'd have to defer to Mr. Dixon if you'd prefer to have him.
Members of the committee, were any of you around at that time? Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe three of the members present today were here, and so my understanding with staff is that there is no additional information that's presented.
All the additional information was that one tax, basically that one tax record, as far as the income that was being generated from the sod farm. As I said, there were questions as far as, and I can refer back to, there were actually a couple of questions that in the intervening year, Michelle Timmons, who was the prior counsel to this subcommittee, wrote up sort of her findings when the case was laid over as to the statute of limitation on these claims, this type of claim, which was one question that was asked 2 years ago. And, you know, and again, the DNR evidence that was presented at the time as to the when flooding on this property was found. DNR records go back to 78, 79 as far as when Mr. Dixon began looking for ways to ease the flooding on his property. And again, Ms. Timmons had done a thorough investigation of the statute of limitations on these type of claims and found that for, I believe, most are 6 years, and the longest that she could find were 15 years. And, you know, at this case, at this point, you know, the hearing, the administrative hearings that went on as far as the order to fill the ditch were done 30 years ago. They went through a review process, the ALJ. You know, I think everything that, you know, as far as that process, you know, was completed again 30 years ago. And there's evidence that the flooding at least goes back to within DNR records, the late 70s, and that it was marked in maps as wetlands earlier than that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And unless I'm, you know, the members who are present can remind me, without the additional information of being able to size what the income was and be able to, you know, have that additional information, I think that we need to follow the staff recommendation that was presented previously. You know, because again, there's no additional information, and so I'm inclined to move to agree with the staff recommendation.
Other questions that members may have, Senator Ralph?
Just quickly, as I understand it, the flooding had been occurring prior to the original ditch being constructed, and the. And I don't see any information as to whether that ditch actually alleviated any flooding. It appears that there was a breach on the, I'd say, north end of the ditch that actually allowed the public, the other natural drainage ditch, to then flow into the artificially constructed ditch. But I don't see anything in the records that indicates the condition after the ditch was dug, but before the breach had occurred. From what I can see from the record, there's been a continuous period of an evidence of flooding on and off, depending on whether we're in a dry or a wet year. Is my understanding of the situation correct?
Members? Sounds, anything that you can add to that, Mr. Peterson, or... Are your testifiers?
Yes, Senator. Just briefly, and then I'll let Mr. Dixon be permitted to testify. One of the issues that the DNR sent us back for was basically to provide evidence that there was not flooding occurring. The distinction is the fact that he had a fully operational sod field operation from the late 60s, mid to late 60s until the late 80s. Even though there may have been flooding occurring, he had an operational sod field. Due to the hydrology in the area, you've got 2 6-foot culverts coming under the railroad southerly of Highway 55, and another 6-footer or 4-footer, four-footer coming from Dean Lake, and that feeds into a 6-foot culvert that goes through Mr. Dixon's property, which it can't take that intake. So, since the late 1980s, that there's no sod field you can produce there. I mean, the ground is muddy and wet. So from a standpoint of responding to the DNR's request. That's the pictures that were attached to our submission in February basically show clearly on the pictures themselves that there were sod fields under till in operation in which he was gaining income from during that period. So that would be more of the distinction, Senator.
Sir, could you identify yourself for the tape and proceed with any evidence or extra testimony that you'd like to give? Just identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Dean Dixon. And I don't hear too well what goes on up there. But I want to tell you, I was in the sod field for 22 years. Now, the first year I just planted it and kept it mowed, and I wholesaled it for $8,000. Now, back in those days, $8,000 was a lot of money. The next year, I bought a cutter, and all I did was cut it, and people would pick it off the field. I took in $9,000. I didn't even cut half of the field. The next year, I bought a truck. So many people were calling for delivery. So I delivered. Then I made $20,000. Then there was $30,000. Well, then after a few years, well, quite a few years, the natural waterway was dammed off. I was completely flooded. Well, I was lucky. I had sold $9,000 worth of sod before they got the dam installed. Well, this natural waterway went way up the river, 5 miles. There was very little fall in that 5 miles, but it did drain. But they put in that dam. There was no fall. It flooded everything up. So what I did, I dug a ditch across my back 40 and run the water right down here, 2 miles to the river. It was going up there, coming back down. I dug this ditch, and while this ditch was open, for the years it was open, there was no flooding anywhere. I never lost one roll of sod. They ordered me to close the ditch after so many years, and it wasn't only an order, it was a threat. It says, if you don't close the ditch, we'll hire somebody and put it on your taxes, and you'll have to pay. So I closed the ditch. Pretty soon I got another letter. It said you have to put a mound over the ditch. So I hired him to come back and put a mound over it. Now there was no water could have went over it before. Well, pretty soon I got another letter. It said you either have to seed over the top or sod over the top. Well, I called Dale Hammuth is the one that from the DNR that was sending me these letters. So I called and I said, I want to talk to Dale Hammuth. Oh, he's transferred out of the area. Well, there I sat, out of business, and I've been after him ever since, trying to get him to do something. What this left was 2 6-foot and 1 4-foot culvert draining into my property and 1 6-foot culvert leading out. It's like trying to put 16 pounds of sugar in a 6-pound bag, and they'll do nothing. And they treat you like an animal. I called Roger at the DNR one day, and here's what he said. He said, you know, I was on the farm once too, and then I went to store work in the store. He said, we bought eggs from the farmer for 15 cents a dozen. We sold them for 30 cents a dozen. He says, and we're all smart up here. Of course, I know I'm a dumb farmer, but I don't like to hear it from the DNR.
Sir, if you could identify yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Colvin. I am Deputy Director for the Ecological and Water Resources Division in the Department of Natural Resources.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I think what I'll do is, since the discussion is around the ditch that Mr. Dixon dug, I'll focus on that for the time being. And in the packet that we provided in 2016, there is a map. It's figure 2. It's the site location map. And so that will give you kind of a visual as I kind of go through and describe what happened here. The just to orient you to the map, that orange line is the two-mile ditch that Mr. Dixon dug. And that yellow dot is approximately where it started. The blue line right above that is the public water course that we're talking about. And then you can see that that ditch drains into another water course down south.
Sir, 1 minute, please. Senator Ralph.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I don't see a colored exhibit in here.
Did the DNR send a colored map to committee?
We
don't have a colored map.
Oh.
I have a figure two site location map, but it's not colored.
It's not colored. Bummer. Okay. Are you able to see kind of the features I'm talking about, Mr. Chair?
Members, are you able to distinguish on figure two site location map? It's page 124 for those who are trying to look on. Can everybody see that? Okay. We have somewhat of an idea what you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I'll continue. So in 1984, Mr. Dixon was talking with then area hydrologist Dale Holmuth about relieving some flooding problems in his sod field, and talked about doing something like this. He had been talking, I think other testifiers mentioned that he had been talking with other DNR staff about this in 1978, and apparently with some county staff up in the years prior. And he talked about running this ditch from the public water course to the other water course in the southeast. And during the site visit, Mr. Holmuth told him, well, you can't, you know, we wouldn't authorize that. You'd be capturing the stream flow from the public water course and sending it in an entirely different direction. So Mr. Dixon asked about ending the ditch before it connected with the public water course, and Mr. Holmuth told him that, well, that would not require a DNR permit, but if it erodes up into the public water, we're going to have a concern. That is going to be an unauthorized work in public waters, and we'll have to issue a restoration order. Long and short of it is that that's exactly what happened. Mr. Dixon originally dug the ditch not connecting to that public water course, but it eroded up into the water course, captured the flow, and sent the flow south into that smaller non-public water and down into Rice Lake, a wetland. And in 1985, we were getting complaints from some of the folks living southeast about high water problems, did the investigation, found the issue with the head cut, and issued a restoration order. Mr. Dixon requested a contested case hearing by an administrative law judge. We did that. We had testimony from staff, from others, several of the landowners who were adversely affected by this or claimed to be adversely affected by this testified as well. The administrative law judge affirmed the and recommended that the DNR issue the restoration order as a final order, which our commissioner did in 1986. Mr. Dixon at that time had available to him but did not exercise the option to appeal the case to the State Court of Appeals. And so the order was final, and as Mr. Dixon said, he did eventually restore the area. A couple of attempts to make sure that we wouldn't get a return of the head cut and that the materials were stabilized, as he testified to.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. Any further questions for the DNR?
Could I say something?
Mr. Peterson?
Senator, could we ask a question of the DNR?
Go ahead.
Procedurally. Thank you. Mr. Colvin, you state there's a water control, water level control structure that was constructed on the Van Lith property. Is that correct?
That's where the dam is.
Yeah.
Mr. Colvin?
Mr. Chair, members, there is a water control structure for waterfall improvement. The Van Liths requested that permit. Let me see when that was issued. The permit did have conditions that it not in 50-year flood circumstances, that it not back up water above the bottom of the closest upstream culvert. The work was inspected and approved. So the department does not think that it would be very likely at all, in fact, extremely unlikely that it would back up 2 miles and affect Mr. Dixon's property. Even given the relative, the pretty flat conditions in the area.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Senator. Just briefly, that water level control feature is correctly stated southerly of Mr. Dixon's property. It's westerly of County Road 14, where the six-foot culvert comes underneath. As Mr. Dixon testified, and as the pictures show in my submission as Exhibit H, those are the 2 6-foot culverts coming under the railroad tracks. Mr. Colvin's map shows the 6-foot or the 4-foot coming in off the Dean Lake map to the west, northwest. And then he's got the 6-foot underneath the road. So basically it kind of gets back to Mr. Dixon's analogy of the 16 pounds of sugar into a 6-pound. You can't do it. They're getting quashed on both ways. And again, the hydrology of the area is such that the sod field cannot be a sod field, whereas from 1960, mid-60s, all the way through the late 80s, that was an operational sod field. Now it's no income-producing property whatsoever.
Can I say something?
Mr. Dixon.
Mr. Chairman, can I say something?
Mr. Dixon, go ahead.
This ditch that I dug goes to the river 2 miles. There's 16 feet of fall. How much flooding do you think there would be along that? He said the farmers hollered about flooding. Well, Herman Dronick, that was Dennis Bisey's uncle. Those are the two that ordered this to be talked to Dale Holmuth or whatever to have it closed. He's the one that ordered me. They're the two that were screaming. So they came saying that they were getting flooded. That was Herman Dronick did get flooded up there in the hills because the beaver did block off the culvert under the railroad. They built a dam there, so he did get some flooding because of that, but it had nothing to do with the ditch.
Okay. Members, any other further questions for the DNR, for Mr. Peterson, Mr. Dixon? Any further conclusions or insights? None? Senator Elf?
Mr. Chair, the thing I'm trying to ascertain is apparently there was a ditch that was dug that did not divert the water course at the beginning. Mr. Chair, am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Colvin?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct. When that ditch was initially built, It did not connect to the public water course. Its purpose was to capture overland flooding from when the water, public water course would come out of its banks and take some of that southeast and provide some relief to Mr. Dixon in that manner.
So the, as I understand it then, that ditch, and maybe Mr. Dixon, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dixon could answer this. It, did that ditch alleviate any flooding after it was built before it, before the public water course was, or the north end of the ditch breached the public water course? Did that alleviate any flooding before the, when you first built the ditch?
Yeah, after I got that ditch, there was no flooding.
So this was before, but before the ditch actually was breached, or the ditch, before it connected to the public water course.
Unless we get a real heavy rain, I would get a little flooding, but it had to be a maybe a 6-inch or something.
But that was before the berm was breached between your ditch and the public water course. That's correct?
I don't hear. What did he say?
Sorry, he can't hear you.
I'm sorry. There's the ditch when it was originally built did not connect to the public water course.
That was it had to be public because the county even helped dig that. They paid like 20%, and the landowner paid 80% in order.
All right, and what I guess I'm trying to get at is, was there any flooding before the breach of the public water course to the public water course? I'm looking at a map. I don't know if you have the exhibit in front of you, but I'm looking at the hand-drawn map that's exhibit, well, it doesn't have an exhibit number on it, but it's part of exhibit one. There's some handwritten materials, and then there's a hand-drawn map I can show you. That's, I believe that's it. On the upper right-hand side is where there apparently was a breach of the to the public water course.
Yeah, what about it?
He said there's a breach to the public water course right here.
No, breach.
Breach.
Oh, breached it. What do you mean? This comes this way. Yeah.
That's the one that goes to Iceland.
Yeah.
So there was no interference with the drainage, the overland drainage, to your ditch, because you had to fill that.
Yeah, there would be some come into this ditch yet.
I'm sorry. What I'm trying to determine is that the order of the DNR that we're apparently dealing with is the order to fill the ditch. That is the basis of the claim, as I understand it.
Mr. Dixon.
He said,
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to reach the basis of the claim is what I'm trying to reach. Sir. And the basis of the claim, as I understand it, is that Mr. Dixon was ordered to repair the breach between his private ditch and the public water course. And I'm trying to determine if, in fact, that filling actually caused anything. Because apparently the ditch worked when it wasn't connected to the public water course. And the fact that he had to fill that ditch should not have, if that did not affect the flooding, that action of the DNR is what I believe is at issue here, if I understand the claim correctly.
Mr. Colvin, you want to answer that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. A couple of clarifying things. One is the only portion of the dug ditch that the DNR required restored was that segment that had eroded from the original starting point into the stream channel. So we didn't require him to plug the entire ditch, just that one portion. So essentially it restored it to its originally constructed condition. The other thing I'll provide as a little clarification is the ditch was dug sometime late in 1984, and by the time complaints were coming in mid-1985, it had already eroded all the way back into the stream. So I think just because of the short amount of time it took, it might be difficult to ascertain exactly what sorts of benefits that ditch provided, because it eroded so quickly in a matter of months.
Senator Ralph?
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. What I'm trying to determine is, in order for a claim to succeed, the DNR has to have done something that caused the flooding. And I'm trying to ascertain what it is that Mr. Dixon claims that the DNR did that caused this flooding. That's the trouble I'm having with this case.
Mr. Peterson, any comments on that?
The only reason this ditch was closed was to flood me out. That's the only reason. Dennis Bisey lost his farm. He couldn't make any money. Herman Dronick up in the hills couldn't make any money. Here I was making. I put three kids through 12 years of college, and I paid off the farm. So, you know, I was making some money. And they were jealous, so they ordered Dale Thomas to close the ditch, and he went ahead and ordered me to close the ditch. I'm out of business right now. It didn't only cost me $1 million. It cost Wright County $5 million. They had to put in all new culverts and build two bridges on County Road 14. It goes under the road six times, this water that comes out of Dean Lake. It goes out into mine and into Corey Flynn's, into Ethel, into Van Lith, and under two places of river, the river and the overflow. So it's six places they had to build. And the headlines in the Wright County Press was, it costs Wright County $5 million. So what happens to our taxes? They go up. Our valuation goes up. And they raised my valuation after the flooding. My valuation went down $200,000, but then they raised it to pay for these taxes that cost $5 million to build the road. And with mine, I feel I lost $1 million because of my equipment. It was used in good working condition, but it's like a used car. How much is a car with $100,000? That's what my equipment was. Good working condition. I've still got an H farm all running good. But one day, of course, everybody could see my soil field was flooded. A guy came by, and I had an eminent H farm all. I was so depressed. I know he didn't want to buy them. He's a neighbor just come by. I'll give you $2,000 for the pair. I said, sold. Well, it wasn't long. The word was out that I was selling my equipment. A guy come by, offered me for my Brilliant Theater $150. Sold. Pretty soon a guy come. I didn't have an auction. I sold him all my equipment. My cousin bought a new tractor, familiar to M tractor. It cost him $42,000. So you'd see what I was losing besides all the side. Now, after I was in it about 10 years, the side business got so good, I even rented land and raised more side. Well, that happened to be in the same water flow as my field. That got flooded out too. So you see how much I lost with this. Even though I did make money to start with, I was just starting to make a little for myself after the kids were through college and my dad was getting old and I was getting up there a little bit too near retirement age. And so I started just wholesaling the thigh again. All I did was seed it and keep it mowed, and I would take in $30,000 then because the price of sod had gone up. So you see where I sit now. And I even had a heart attack after these guys giving me the runaround. I'd call one and, I'd call Roger, you got to go to Kerry. I'd go to Kerry. You got to go to Julie. And then they'd say, we'll get together and we'll work something out. We'll get back to you. And then you'd go back, he's not here today. And just give you the runaround all the time. And this has gone on ever since. It's still going on today. Here I sit with them. 2 6-foot culverts and a 4-foot draining into my property and 1 6-foot. It's not only ruining the side field, it's ruining a lot of my other property too. So I want to thank the DNR.
Mr. Peterson, any final comments?
No, sir.
Representative Quam, you had a motion that you want to make. Could you just give us some details to your motion and then go ahead with it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. because, well, the three of us had heard the previous testimony. There doesn't appear to be some of the, you know, the additional documentation. And I would move that we accept the subcommittee counsel's recommendation on this claim and deny the claim.
Motion has been made that based on not enough information and based on the council's recommendation to deny the claim. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Aye. Claim is denied.
Thank you.
Our next claim is Hunter Winfields Incorporated. Marjorie and Mike Christensen, if they could come forward. And any other testifiers come forward to testify on their claim.
Mr. Chair, I'll summarize the claim.
Mr. Counsel, Jason.
The claimants asked for $245,575.41 for the loss of revenue due to the Department of Natural Resources walleye regulations on Lake Mille Lacs. The claimants own a resort on Lake Mille Lacs that specializes in walleye fishing experiences. Beginning in 2013, the DNR adopted a series of rules restricting walleye fishing on Lake Mille Lacs, including a catch and release season in 2016. The harvest of walleye in Lake Mille Lacs is subject to regulation under state law and federal court decree entered into with the Mille Lacs Band of Chippewa versus Minnesota. There was submitted a lot of modeling and scientific analysis on the walleye population in Lake Mille Lacs that I think is best to hear from the DNR on as far as the, you know, the science on that and the regulations that came from that. It was adopted by emergency rulemaking.
Thank you, Mr. Coonley. Is that how you pronounce the last name?
Keenly.
Keenly? Okay, I'll get it right someday.
Yeah. You're good, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. I'm guessing that we have Mike and Marjorie and the attorney. And if one, each, whoever would like to go first, please identify themselves for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Masteller. I'm an attorney that represents Hunter Winfields and Mike and Marjorie in this matter. I do have Mike and Marjorie here with me. And we have submitted documents. I would like to submit an updated spreadsheet for the committee's reference, if that would be allowed. And there is some spreadsheets attached in our submission. This is an updated spreadsheet that reflects generally the same information. And if the committee would accept it for a purpose of a demonstrative purpose here, that would be appreciated.
There are enough copies?
I have six.
And okay. Believe you. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Keenley did a very good job analyzing our claim here. We have documents. We're willing to take any questions that anyone has here. We understand that this is not the time or the place to discuss the policies or politics of the management of Mille Lacs Lake. What we're here to do today is to show the committee the losses that Mike and Marjorie and Hunter Winfields have experienced due to the regulations imposed by the DNR. And I will have Mike and Marjorie fill in as needed, but Hunter Winfields is a full-service resort located in Isle, Minnesota, which is on the southeastern shore of Lake Mille Lacs. It was established in the 1930s, and Mike and Marjorie purchased it in 2006. After purchasing it, they'd made a substantial investment of both time and money in order to improve the resort so that it could be so that it could be something profitable and something they could devote their life to and enjoy. During the period of 2007 to 2009, they doubled their revenue. And then from 2009 to 2011, the revenue doubled again due to all the improvements that they had made. And in 2012, the walleye limit was 4 walleye per person, which provided a very good opportunity for anglers to come that were seeking a trophy fish of a lifetime, and also gave them an opportunity to go home with dinner if they so choose to do so. I will have Mike and Marjorie identify a few of the improvements that they made between 2006 and 2012 to the original resort site.
Ma'am or sir, if one of you want to start to just identify themselves.
Sure, I can. My name is Margie Christensen. I am one of the owners of Hunter Winfields Resort in Isle.
Welcome to committee, and please go ahead with your testimony.
As Alex stated, when we took over the resort, we put a substantial amount of money into it. We bought the resort from a family who had owned it for 60 years. We're only the third family that's ever owned it. It's historical on the lake. Prior to that, it was Carlson's, built in the 30s. When we took it over, there were only a few cabins remaining, so we redid all of the cabins, and there had been 2 that had been knocked down, so we built 2 new cabins. We built a new launch boat. We built up the guide the business. My husband here grew up on the lake. He has fished the lake his entire life. We were on a very strong trend, as you can see from our numbers. We attracted new clientele. A lot of the mom and pops have gone to the wayside on Mille Lacs. We attracted families. We get people from out of state. That is reflective in that growth that you see there. It's because we did substantial marketing. It's because we put a lot of money into making the cabins nice. We get youth groups like the YMCA coming. We really built the business on just promoting what nature has to offer. And you can see where our numbers started to decline is, you know, we'll let Alex pick up from there, but it's painful for us to look at these numbers and see that everything we've put in has been slashed in half.
And so the committee, one side of the spreadsheet provides information from 2007 through 2016. And that's, I apologize if the numbers are small, but that's the way we could fit it all in. And as you'll see, there's percentages that are identified each year. And that's the growth, the numbers in black, the percentages. That's the growth that was experienced each year by Hunter Winfields. The growth in revenue. They continued to grow, grow by 25% from the prior year in 2012. In 2013, that was the first year where the regulations for walleye went from 4 fish to 2 fish, and the slot for the 2 fish that you could keep was between 18 and 20 inches with 1 above 28 inches. That was a serious departure from what had been the case and what they had been experiencing. And in that year, that first full year during that time period, they lost 10% in revenue. The next year, 2014, it was the same limit imposed by the DNR, but they also added a nighttime fishing ban. And that took away evening and late night launches, which were very popular and were very productive. You caught a lot of fish. The same limit was imposed, but you couldn't be on the lake past 10 p.m. During that year, they lost another 8% from the year before and 17% down from their baseline year of 2012. In 2015, the limit was further restricted and to 1 fish per person. And there was, along with that, a lot of added publicity that the lake was in bad shape. Despite that publicity and despite the limit, The Christensens were operating business as usual, trying very hard and bringing customers in, having good success in fishing, and nothing had been much different in this year as opposed to any other year. But that year, due to that coupled with the closure of the season for all fishing on August 4th of 2015, resulted in them losing 22% from years 2014 to 2015 and 36% off of their baseline. As we all know, in 2016, the season was catch and release only the entire season, and it was ultimately closed. And they lost 18% off of the previous year, and they were down 47% in revenue on their baseline year. And so the basis of our claim is not here to argue the merits or the policy or, there's a lot of politics that go into this. We're not here to argue that. We're here to show the DNR did an action. They made a decision. Here's how it affected us. What we're seeking here is not losses starting in 2013. Our losses we've limited to when the closure of the season began in 2015. We think that had the most severe impact, as you can see on the graph. And on that is more finely displayed on the backside of the spreadsheet, which really just includes the 2015 and 2016 year. Along with this resort in 2013, Hunter Winfield's and the Christensens purchased a restaurant 8 miles north of Isle at Liberty Beach in anticipation of opening the restaurant. The restaurant, because of the downturn in 2013, never really opened. They still own it and are still maintaining it and trying to get it leased out, but it never did open. And so we've
included... For a little bit. We shut it down. Yep.
You shut it down, mm-hmm. And there's not... On this page as well, identifies the mortgage payments from the closure along with property taxes. And therefore, we ask the committee to assist Hunter Winfield's in the losses that they've had. They're trying to keep it a family-run resort. They got kids that they intend to turn it over to. This is just something that can assist them in actually realizing that dream.
Thank you. Mr. Masteller, members, are there any questions for Mr. Masteller or the Christensen at this point? Mr. Keenly, anything else to add to the testimony?
Yeah, I think we should probably hear from the DNR as far as their response, but I'll summarize a few things of their statements going into this. This is certainly a sympathetic case, and part of the role of this subcommittee is finding that responsibility and finding that connection back to the state. And that is where the DNR had points out, and where my analysis is that what is the state responsibility in this? The DNR point out, using Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, that there's not a right to the fish. The claimants in this case don't have a right to the walleye. There's establishment in the Minnesota Constitution and again through the federal treaties as to what the DNR's responsibility in this arena is. And I think it's best to hear from them as far as how they fulfilled that duty in this case. But I would advise that claimants are here because there's not a legal avenue for this. And that's part of the issue here. And so this subcommittee can and has chosen at times to work in more equitable principles. The concept of equity is a complex quasi-legal you know, concept where it's no longer compensation-based. You know, compensation based on the law is I was wrong, so I get this compensatory, you know, this compensatory award. Equitable remedies are, it's a give and take, and it's a question of balancing, you know, what was the state action and what was the state responsibility, what was the state duty to the claimants with what the claimants, what the claimant's loss was in this case. And so, you know, I think, again, hearing from the DNR as to how these regulations came to be is important in establishing whether there was sort of a breach of that duty and what duty may have been owed by the DNR to the claimants versus what action they had to take for legal or based on the purposes underlying the science that they were analyzing at the time.
Thank you, Mr. Keenly. Let's have the DNR come up and testify on behalf of their being the other side of this claim. Welcome to committee, and if you could identify yourself and then please proceed with your testimony, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Fiona Riven. I'm a senior staff attorney.
Excuse me, I didn't quite catch that. Could you just say that again into the microphone?
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Fiona Riven. I'm a senior staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. With me is Don Pereira, chief of the fisheries section at the DNR. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I think that the DNR is sympathetic to the claimants, but
if you could speak into the microphone.
I'm sorry. The DNR is sympathetic to the claimants, but the context and the background of the management of the harvest on the lake cannot be seen in a vacuum as to these individual claimants. Particularly in Minnesota, where it is recognized that fishery resources are held and managed for the public trust, for the benefit of the public at large, not only for this generation, but for generations to come. And because of this, there are hard decisions that have to be made to preserve the state's fisheries. And these are constitutional obligations, but they're also obligations under the public trust doctrine. And further complicating matters, particularly with this lake, is the fact that this is a lake that is subject to treaty management under an ongoing federal court decree that the state is not free to ignore. At the time that the claimants purchased this resort, it was already under treaty management. It was the harvest regulations on the lake have always been subject to change and have changed over time. Not just the most recent changes. Slot limits have changed over time. And the law has long recognized, Minnesota statute has long recognized that the regulations can change in order to meet the requirements of the federal court decree. The restrictions at issue were imposed to protect the lake's walleye population from further decline. There are difficult decisions that need to be made to preserve the population, to preserve the spawning population for the future, preserve the genetic diversity of the fish population in the lake. These are difficult decisions that had to be made to alleviate the pressure on the spawning stock. Allowing the harvest to continue at the historic levels would be contrary to sound fisheries management policy and would violate the state's public trust obligation to manage the fisheries for the benefit of the public. The DNR makes these decisions based on science and technical decisions and attempting to address any potential for long-term decline and long-term economic impact. It is to nobody's benefit to take a short-term view of these issues. And I want to get to the point of this committee is designed to award claims where there's a moral obligation on the state to pay. And I want to highlight that the DNR doesn't believe that there's any wrongful conduct that was undertaken here. The decisions were made after scientific analyses in accordance with a court decree. And the Minnesota law has long recognized that natural resource management decisions may impact private businesses, but doesn't give them special right to relief. That was mentioned earlier. There are Supreme Court cases that say there's no takings if there is an elimination of commercial fishing, for example, on a lake. There are a whole host of factors that are not properly laid at the feet of the DNR that appear to be implicated in the decline in the walleye population. Highlighted a few of those in the DNR submittal. Water clarity, warming temperatures, declines in tulipy, success of other predators. It's a very complicated matter. We submitted the Blue Ribbon Panel report that did an analysis of the population. And public policy doesn't support granting relief in this case. If the DNR didn't act to preserve the spawning stock, we could be subject to a claim in the future for now there aren't any fish. And also want to highlight, there are other fisheries that remain in the lake, and the DNR's actively taken steps to promote these. The Bassmaster tournament was there in 2016. I believe it will be there at the lake in 2017. The legislature did grant a form of economic assistance last session in the Lake Mille Lacs Economic Assistance Program and is contemplating property tax abatement relief in this present session. There are many natural resource-based businesses in the state that suffer losses over time due to resource scarcity and just a mere... There needs to be a wrongful conduct, and the DNR doesn't believe it undertook anything wrongful in the complaint of actions in this case. Ultimately, managing the state's fisheries resources to ensure their continued viability for generations to come would be virtually impossible if private individuals could claim a right to compensation any time a favored species is subject to restrictions imposed for conservation purposes. If the DNR did not make these difficult decisions, again, we could be subject to claims from the future. We would respectfully request that the subcommittee deny claimants' claim for relief. I'm available for questions, or if there are technical questions on the fisheries management side. Like I said, Chief Pereira is here.
Ma'am, would your partner like to identify himself and testify also?
Mr. Chair, my name is Don Pereira. I'm chief of the Section of Fisheries for the Minnesota DNR. I am here to provide technical support and to answer any questions that you might have related to either the history of the lake, how our management policy has had to change over time, and how we got to where we are today and managing Mille Lacs for what we hope will be a sustainable future. So Mille Lacs is... Mille Lacs has gone through dramatic changes that happened even before the eight Indian bands started to exercise their treaty rights. These changes have resulted in about approximately 50% decline in the abundance of walleye in the lake. These changes are related primarily due to improved water quality, increased water clarity. This was documented quite well with our own information, and then it was independently reviewed, and the Blue Ribbon Panel that Fiona just mentioned also came to the same conclusion. So it is the responsibility of the state to manage its population sustainably. It is correct that fishing, either by the state or by the bands, did not cause the problem. But with this fish population in decline, the rate of fishing has to decline as well, or fishing will become the problem. So, for example, we do know that up in the Red Lakes in northern Minnesota, fishing mortality did collapse that walleye population. And both the Red Lake Band and the state of Minnesota had to close their fisheries completely for 7 years. We do not want fishing to become a factor on Mille Lacs, and if we don't closely regulate the take of fish in our fishery and in the band's fishery, then it would become a factor that will lead to further decline of walleye in the lake. And that's the fundamental basis for why we need to have significant restrictions on this fishery.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Barrett, did you say that the water quality improved?
Yes, it did. And I did ask Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. We documented that change clearly beginning in the middle 1990s. Other independent studies have also documented this. And I have asked colleagues in the PCA look at our interpretation of this, and they basically came to the same conclusion that we did.
Senate and, Representative Murphy.
And, Mr. Chair, and there, Ms. Riven, you said that there are other fish, and you have some kind of a tournament, but just for one kind of fish. What other fish are in Mille Lacs?
Ms. Riven?
I'm going to defer to Chief Pereira on that question. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. While Mille Lacs has changed to the detriment of walleye production, it's actually changed to the benefit of smallmouth bass, and smallmouth bass have been increasing fairly dramatically in the lake. There's still a lot more walleye than there are smallmouth bass, but the smallmouth bass population is really exceptional, especially in the size of fish that are available. This big national bass tournament that occurred last September, several of the top bass anglers in the country actually referred to the Mille Lacs smallmouth bass fishery as the best in the country, which is a great thing, and we want to market that. We want to manage bass kind of delicately so they can support this wonderful trophy fishery, but also provide some fish for food as well. Other species in the lake include northern pike and muskellunge. In the fall, we typically see very large muskellunge are our large trophy fish. You don't catch them very often, but when you catch a big one, it's quite spectacular. In the lake, this lake, the past several years in the fall, has been producing very, very large muskellunge, like up to 57 inches in length. Because of the changes in the lake, with clearer water, we have more plant growth. And northern pike like plants. And so, again, northern pike are not as abundant in Mille Lacs as walleye, but their abundance has increased over the past 10 years. And so we have actually expanded opportunities for anglers to use northern pike, both for trophy fishing but also as a food fish as well. For example, two winters ago, we actually dropped the dark house spearing band for northern pike on Mille Lacs, and we did get a very good response with a lot of people showing up to participate in the new dark house spearing fishery for northern pike and Mille Lacs in the winter. So there's quite a number of things that we're doing to really try to promote other fishing opportunities in the lake. And we're also working in partnership with Explore Minnesota Tourism to try to get the word out on other great fishing opportunities that Mille Lacs offers.
Senator Representative Murphy.
My final question then. And Mr. Fair, then when you try to work with the tourism and you try to work with the various organizations, do you also work with the businesses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, we do. We have something that's referred to the Mille Lacs Fisheries Advisory Committee that has about 17 members representing a diversity of interests, but the most well-represented group on the advisory committee are local business owners. And we have several resort owners and a couple of retail store owners as well on this committee. And they meet with us on a regular basis to try to figure out the path forward, as difficult and challenging as that path is.
Representative Murphy, further? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ferreira. Is your background in both limnology and biology?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, my background is primarily in fisheries science and fisheries management, but I am broadly trained. I have had limnological type classes, and I've had also a lot of analytical statistical modeling classes as well. But we do have other subject matter experts available to consult with us on specific questions. And, for example, when I said I went to PCA staff to request their interpretation of what happened with the water quality of Mille Lacs and why it improved, that's an example of where we go ahead and pursue additional outside expert consultation to make sure that our interpretation is correct.
Representative Quam. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so in your statistical analysis and trending analysis, at what point did you ascertain that there was a trending downward of walleye in Mille Lacs?
Mr. Farrar. The trend probably started to be noticeable in the late 1990s. We could see it first in the male walleyes, later on in the female walleyes, and it became, with natural walleye populations, they fluctuate naturally a lot. There's a lot of natural variation. So when you have a natural variation in time series data, you need a lot of data to determine, is that trend real or is it just a temporary downturn? So basically, when we change a regulation on one of our walleye lakes, we're really clear to the public that, you know, we won't really have a feel for whether this regulation is working or not until we have about a decade's worth of data. So it became very apparent to us about 4 or 5 years ago that this downward trend in walleye was real. It wasn't an artifact. And also, we hear people that state that our gill nets are wrong, that are more fish in the lake. It's not just our assessment gill nets. We know the process. We know the biological mechanism that's causing this downturn in walleye. It's increased survival of young, increased mortality of young fish. Again, that was also corroborated by the independent Blue Ribbon panel. We gave them our data. We didn't tell them how we were interpreting it. We said, here's the data. You tell us what's going on. Basically, they came to the same conclusions that we did. So we have young a year. We have assessments on juvenile fish that aren't done with gill nets. They're done with different types of gear. And it was those different types of gear evaluations that showed us these juvenile fish from sometime after their first fall until about 3 years old, their rate of mortality was elevated. We also have to go into the lake about once every 7 to 10 years, and we're going to be doing it next year in 2018 and then in 2019. And we do very intensive tagging studies, or mark recapture studies, if you will, as they're called in the fishery science world, where we put in a lot of effort directly tagging walleyes to directly enumerate how many walleyes in the lake. And when we've done that, those population estimates have corroborated the rest of the story. So we are very, very, very confident that this decline in walleye is real and not an artifact of how we assess the population.
Thank you, Mr. Farrar. Mr. Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, with your feeling of how you do your statistical analysis, I'm surprised that you waited multiple decades, and it appears at least three of the going in and tagging, because you were analyzing the population distribution, the total population, and also the, I assume you analyzed the size and the harvesting rates. And if you had this interaction with the Mille Lacs Fishery Advisory Committee or, you know, the business and the community, at what point did you let them know, oh, gee, for the last 20 years we've been seeing this trend, and give them a heads up? Because, you know, frankly, that's where there would be cause that the DNR was maybe lacking in communicating, because the best way to avoid, you know, the crash like you mentioned in another lake is to be able to communicate and work with the communities around. And I'm just surprised, that your experts weren't able to in the early 2000s, at least have a heads up that we have some concern. And then I assume it was in, around 04 and 11 when you did some of the tagging and additional activity for confirmation of your analysis. I'm just trying to understand why there wasn't communication and heads up ahead of time. Why was the wait until you basically started the crash, and then successive years, restrictions were imposed? I mean, that is what I think has a major impact on the validity of the claim, is leaving them in the dark as this was going on, and it wasn't just, this year it was a dip. No, this is a decades-long trend.
Mr. Farrar.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we have informed our advisory committee. The previous group was called the Mille Lacs Fisheries Input Group. And basically the process for assessing the lake and determining how many fish are there, we'd run our assessment programs into the early fall. Then we assemble all that information, process it, and then we analyze it through a variety of means, but the number one tool that we use is something called statistical catch and age modeling that gives us an estimate of the abundance of fish in the lake. Probably starting in the early 2000s, we started to see symptoms that indicated that something might be changing here. But as I stated, it probably takes about, if we reacted right away at that point, there was still a probability that we would have been reacting prematurely. Again, this population change did not happen because of fishing. It happened because of changes in the dynamics of the young fish in the lake before they're even susceptible to fishing. And we were communicating this to our input group pretty much every step of the way. When we would have a meeting with them, we would meet with them in March to determine what regulation would work well for the coming fishing season. And we would start that meeting by presenting our analysis of the state of the fishery and the state of the walleye population. And as that information became available, we presented it to them. So I think that we did communicate fairly well on how the lake was changing. If we had moved sooner to restrict the walleye, in fact, if you watch how we did bring harvest down, it didn't come down dramatically overnight. I think it was in 1992, the lake set a record for 1.2 million pounds of fish harvested in 1 year. And then when we started more active management of the system, we realized that that one event did not decimate the population, but it was a fishing mortality rate that would have been better if it was a little lower. And so we had restrictive actions in place fairly soon after we started the program that required us to accommodate tribal fishing in the lake. So we were putting restrictions on the fishery overall for quite a while. And as the picture began to unfold, those restrictions became more and more extreme to the point where the population came down to the lowest that we ever observed it. The spawning stock abundance, the abundance of spawners in the lake, hit an all-time low several years ago. And it was that point where we said, well, look, we don't know when the bottom is going to drop out, but we don't want it to go any lower. And that's why we set annual goals that simply stated that we will only allow enough fishing on the lake so as to not exacerbate or accelerate this decline in spawning walleyes in the system. So I think we were moving fairly consistently along the path of changing our management regimes on the lake as we gather new information on how the system was changing.
Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little struggling with, first of all, I mean, I've fished Mille Lacs since I came to Minnesota in 1962. I've watched the lake change. I'm actually one of the people that mapped Mille Lacs for Lake Master Lake Maps. So I'm very familiar with the lake. I am familiar with the Christensens and admire the effort and what they've done. And what's troubled me is over the years I've watched regulations be put in place and taken back and put in place. And I was somewhat surprised to learn that, in fact, You indicated that you believe that it was in 1992 that you thought there might be there was an identifiable decline, but you weren't sure whether it was permanent or just part of the cycle. I can remember back in the 70s when Mille Lacs was not a very good fishery, but you could still take fish. And we managed to go through those years without having to completely restrict the taking of fish on the lake. What troubles me is, while apparently there was some attempt to notify people of the fact that we're looking at this, that the draconian measure of totally shutting down the lake for fishing, as was done on Red Lake, for, I believe, other reasons, that created a situation that we have an obligation in government, and in fact I think council will agree that I believe there is some case law that actually says that regulation must take into effect or into account the economic effect that regulation may have. And I am concerned that there was not at least an apparent clear message sent to the people who were involved in this, that we have some real trouble here. As early as, even though you may not have been taking steps, that as you said, as early as 2007, I believe, that you really had recognized that we're probably in trouble here, and that we may have to take some severe measures. And it is that makes me pause as to where we go. Now, I recognize the precedent that this might set in terms of granting this claim. On the other hand, I am concerned that as we go forward, that we don't place businesses, which the economic engine of this state is tourism. You know, we can talk about anything else, but tourism is probably one of the major economic engines that drives this state. And I think in trying to make Minnesota a better place, to improve its economy, I am very concerned that we have allowed regulations to impact businesses in the way it has. That being said, we do have an obligation to the people of Minnesota to protect that valuable resource. And I don't think the Christensens would disagree with that, not by one bit. I think the issue is the I won't say surprise, but apparently the suddenness and the lack of apparent notice that came forward in this. And I guess that's just my observations at this point, and if you have some comment or something to address that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Farr?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph. The changes in the lake, the initial changes in the lake, water clarity improving, were fairly subtle, and they started in the mid-90s. And then we didn't really see changes in the dynamics of walleye until probably 5 or so years after that. So again, with biological systems that are noisy, you need a fair amount of information before you can start, you know, sounding off the alarm bells. And one of the things that we've been coached to do by the local businesses is not to be too alarming because it drives business away. So we've processed this information carefully. We've worked on the outreach very delicately with our stakeholders to let them know what's going on without being overly alarmist, but at the same time realizing that there could be changes happening in this system and we're going to have to do something to respond to it. Now, we can't deny the fact that the Federal District Court upheld the treaty in that we have to accommodate fishing by 8 Indian bands that can fish independent of state regulation. So we have to, when we do all of our analysis and determine how to manage the system, we have to do that in collaboration with the Indian bands and with their technical experts. And so if we try to have more liberal regulations at during the period when the walleye population was in decline, we would have, first of all, the bands likely wouldn't have agreed to it. And then if we can't argue based on conservation that what we're doing is right, and we can't do that based on the science, we wouldn't have won that argument with the bans. And so we would have, if we did win it, then we would have probably had excessive fishing anyways, and we would be in a more difficult situation today than we would have otherwise. So I do feel that we do need to incorporate social and economic needs in managing our natural resources. And typically in fish populations that are healthy and robust, a fish manager that's managing a recreational fishery, an angling fishery, has a lot of latitude with no conservation concerns to go to the stakeholder and say, how would you like us to manage this fishery? Do you want a trophy fishery? Do you want a harvest fishery? There's plenty of room to incorporate social and economic need. When a population gets in the more dire conservation need, then the more focused need to conserve the population and restrict the take of fish is what is necessary for future sustainability. Because otherwise, we're going to be hurting future generations if we make the problem even worse.
Senator Ralph.
And I don't disagree with the fact that we have to look forward. I guess I'm still a little bit troubled, and I understand that there are many factors involved. What kind of conversations did the DNR have with the various business owners regarding how you wanted this lake managed? I mean, I know that the muskie population has grown tremendously. The smallmouth, I remember when the smallmouth regulations were put into effect, and it's a wonderful smallmouth fishery. But Mille Lacs people came to Minnesota for walleye. For Mille Lacs. That's what they did. And I know that, and believe me, I understand how difficult your job is, having been very closely in line with the fishing industry for many years. As I said, I still bring the question is exactly how much communication took place and what nature. Was this something that the Christensens, and I might add virtually every other resort business on the lake, was given adequate information regarding what was going on? I guess that's kind of my bottom line.
Mr. Farrar.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senator Ralph, I think our communications were very detailed and very transparent. All of our, we produce a large technical document every year in December that we use for the basis of how we make our management decisions. All of that is in the public record. We share that openly. We even post it online for people that want that information, including our career reports and all of that. All of that has been made available to the public. The only time we withhold it if it's a work in progress and it's not complete yet. But our public has come to expect these reports every year, and we make them available all the time. So I think we are completely transparent. Our conversations with what was initially called the Mille Lacs Fishery Input Group and now is called the Advisory Committee have been very detailed over time, very arduous, but also very useful. For example, with smallmouth bass, what we're doing with smallmouth bass is we're kind of refereeing this contrast in the users, because there's some group that are trophy anglers, or they might be a guide that caters to a trophy angler, and they don't want us to kill any bass at all. So we have a regulation that's designed to allow. Then you have the classic walleye operators, launch operators, who are suffering more than any others because they have a clientele that want to come up, they want to go out to launch, and they want to bring some walleyes home. So we're trying to accommodate smallmouth bass also as a food fish for some of those operators. And so those discussions, I feel like I have to be a referee between those that want trophy fishing and those that want to go ahead and harvest some smallmouth for their clientele because they want to eat a meal of fish. So these conversations are very detailed. They're, you know, if you step back and look at them, they're very interesting, but they're also pretty arduous at a time. I mean, at times. We have, sometimes when the committee gets together, they're arguing with themselves more so than they are with us. And Northern Pike is a really good example of this, because when we had Northern Pike expanding in abundance, we actually, the regulation we have for Northern Pike right now is called Earner Trophy. So we wanted anglers to make use of the abundant northern pike, smaller than 30 inches, but don't harvest too many big fish. And so one of the local operators came up with this idea of called Erna Trophy. If you want to kill a pike larger than a certain size, then you first have to harvest two smaller than 30 inches. That came from our stakeholders. So we do listen to them very closely, and we try to incorporate their information. Now, what's happened over time,
Mr. Farrar, because I think there's somebody else that has a question. I think you've answered his question. Okay. I think we need to move this along. We're rambling here. Senator, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a series of questions. To the DNR representative, Mr. Farrar, could you help me with the timeline? You mentioned in the late 1990s you started to see a decrease in the walleye population. Is that correct?
The decline in the walleye population probably did not become apparent, from a statistical standpoint, until the early 2000s.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'd stated earlier in testimony that it was the late 1990s. Are you amending that comment?
Mr. Farrar?
Yes or no suffices.
Yes. I would say that the decline, we probably did not, because you can have, natural walleye population, you can have a decline for 3 years or more for just purely random reasons.
Sir, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I appreciate, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your nuanced answer.
Sure. Okay.
In the interest of time, yes or no suffices for these.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Smith?
Thank you. So in the early 2000s, you noticed a decline in data or a decline in fish, and it takes roughly 10 years in order to attain the proper amount of data. So that brings us to roughly 2011, give or take. Yet there was 5 or so, 6 years. It seems like there's a gap. Briefly help me understand what happened there.
Mr. Farrar?
Our Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, our stock assessment models indicated that abundance was coming down, and so the method of calculating our safe harvest levels would also come down lockstep with that. And as we were doing detailed assessments on the changes in the lake and what were causing the dynamics, the population was coming down in abundance, not in an alarming way until probably the middle to late 2000s, when we fully realized and we had the independent assessment done to show that we now know that these young fish have changed their behavior, they have higher levels of mortality, and now the replenishment of the spawning stock by a reduced supply of young fish could put this population in long-term peril if we don't restrict fishing. And all that started happening about the middle to late 2000s as we were gathering more information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, you mentioned earlier that you were confident that you knew what the problem is, that you know what the problem is. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Farrar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But additionally, sir, you mentioned that there could be some changes coming in the system. Did you mean changes in your analysis that you know what the problem is or was?
There's additional layers to the changes in Mille Lacs that we have because of invasive species. So we know that the initial changes happened because of increased water clarity. We saw a change in behavior of young walleyes that indicated that was the key driver. But now we have a team of scientists that are trying to also determine how the food web is changing because of two primary invasive species, spiny water flea and zebra mussels.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. So to the testifier, I understand you're not a marketing expert, but you'd mentioned some marketing issues before. So a couple of questions about that. You talk about how now Mille Lacs Lakes is being marketed for other types of fish. Is that correct?
Mr. Farrar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we are trying to help the local business communities adapt to utilize species of sport fish in the lake that are doing very well.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the past, has the DNR worked on marketing or stated that Mille Lacs was known specifically for the type of fish we're speaking of this evening?
Mr. Farrar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, until we started to realize that these changes in Mille Lacs are very profound, we did not have an overt need to market other species in the lake. It was primarily a walleye lake.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it was marketed as a primarily walleye lake.
Mr. Farrar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's largely correct.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so it was determined, and it was fair to say that the general population in the fishing community knew that lake to be titled as such.
Mr. Farrar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's largely correct. It was. It did. It has earned its reputation as a walleye lake.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. And to Ms. Ribbon, is it?
Yes.
Ms. Ribbon, what is your role at the DNR?
I'm a senior staff attorney in the general counsel's office.
Thank you. So you mentioned earlier in your testimony there's a Supreme Court case talking about no taking and no rights to claim. Could you cite that case, please,
Ms. Ribbon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I don't have it off the top of my head. I know it was cited in our submission that was submitted on February 17th.
Representative Smith.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. Is that submission in our materials here, staff? Thank you. All right, I can reference that. Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith.
Thank you. So this claim, is it proper in your opinion, considering the reference to the Supreme Court case, that this claim be brought forward to this committee?
Ms. Ribbon?
Chair Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I'm not. Can you restate that?
Representative Smith?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You'd mentioned this Supreme Court case, and you implied that if there's no taking, there's no right to a claim. And the implication, at least from my perspective, was that you were stating that this claim was invalid to be brought forward to this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's not what I was trying to state. I was more trying to state that it's a recognition of the non-private interest at issue in the state's fisheries, and that there's no in that case there's no compensable taking, but it's a recognition of these are resources that are managed for the public good, not for the private commercial good. But I don't think it addresses the jurisdiction of this committee.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're stating that this claim is the proper venue to hear this type of issue.
Ms. Ribbon?
Chair Representative Smith, the venue may be appropriate, but I think that the claim at issue, like I tried to identify, is the claims that are to be brought here are those under the rules in which there's a moral responsibility of the state to pay, and that the equities support issuing a claim to the claimants, and I don't believe that the equities in this case support that, particularly when these management decisions are made for the public good and pursuant to a federal court decree. So while the venue may be correct, I'm not conceding that we believe that the claim is accurate and should be granted by the committee.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And certainly you can have an opinion about the venue, but the opinion about the validity of the claim is something that this committee holds.
Ms. Rebin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I understand that. I'm making an argument on behalf of the DNR.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspected as much, just seeking clarification. And so when you're speaking for the DNR.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I'm here in response to the DNR. We were asked to respond to the claim.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So earlier you stated about this wrongful conduct is needed. You cited specific language. Where did you reference the terms wrongful conduct from?
Ms. Ribbon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the moral obligation, I mean, I think it's a take on the moral obligation of the state and the equities at issue, which is referenced in the rules of the subcommittee.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So it isn't a legal term per se. You were just speaking to the overall validity of the claim.
Ms. Ribbon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, speaking to the validity of the claim in the subcommittee and the recognition that of the purpose of this subcommittee, that again, there's a moral obligation of the state. It's not merely a strict liability. This subcommittee is not set up to be a strict liability. X happened accordingly. I am entitled to Y.
Representative Smith, any
thank you,
follow-up?
Mr. Chair. That's
okay.
It.
Any further questions? Any comments? We need to make a decision. Any other further comments from the audience that want to come forward? Would the claimants like to come and make another round here before we make a final decision?
Mr. Chairman, I think they're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay.
I want to hear from an excellent walleye guide from Mille Lacs. I'm sure he's happy to speak, but we'll just await your delivery.
Okay, thank you. Members, Representative Murphy.
About the marketing that the
Christensen could come forward. Ms. Christensen?
Sure. We've been marketing in conjunction with the new Do the Lake campaign, which started, I would say, probably around the time where they started taking away our fish. And so we're countering the marketing to the bass population, to musky fishermen. You know, it's going to take some time for that message to resonate. We have been known as a walleye lake. And so we've lost that group, and we're trying to bring new ones to the lake. So we're not giving up on the lake either. And it makes me happy to hear that the DNR is so optimistic about where this lake is going, which makes me feel like, you know, if we've got some money to keep going forward, that we're going to be successful. And we all want the lake to do great. But we are changing our marketing message. But, you know, there's still people coming for that trophy walleye. You know, we just hope one day we can keep one. And I don't know if you want to say anything about the fishery. No? Okay. All right.
Representative Murphy.
And then just as a follow-up to that, then the numbers of people that come, there's more fishery people that come, but are there more people coming just to enjoy the resort of fishing?
I feel like we're seeing different people come, yes. I feel like, you know, late in the summer, we get people that aren't necessarily concerned with how many walleye they can keep. They're coming to enjoy the resort, yes. We're attracting that different clientele, and that's what we have to continue to be able to market to, is that. And we are broadening our message that way and seeing corporate people. We saw a lot of corporate come this winter. We did sell off a number of our ice houses because our business had been so down, but we did see different groups of people that we hadn't seen before, so it makes us feel like the marketing efforts that have been going on are starting to work.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Representative Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Christensen. In your statement that you provided to this committee, you talked about the economic assistance program. Have you taken attempted to take advantage of any of that?
And we have, yes. And okay. We feel that that's a program to help us go forward as well. And we feel that this coming to this claims committee is another way to get that economic relief. It was a loan, as you know, mm-hmm. Which isn't the same. We've lost a lot of revenue, as you can see from those numbers. So we're trying to reach out to different avenues, and this claims process was one that was brought to our attention as one that could be a viable option for what we've gone through.
Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'm thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to move to a motion if you're
okay.
Ready for that.
I'm ready to hear
Mr.
that
Chair,
motion.
I make a motion for this committee to approve a claim on $150,000 based on a variety of factors. Some of the numbers are there's a lot of data that's been submitted, but I think in summation, considering the testimony we heard and the fault of the DNR, my motion is for $150,000.
Motion before us by Representative Smith that we approve a claim for the Hunter Winfields, the Christensens of $150,000. Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, the committee will proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion to give a claim of $150,000 for the losses to the Hunter Winfields Incorporated Christensen's group, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried, and the claim has been filed as a claim of $150,000 for the Christensen's. Thank you for coming. Case is dismissed. Thank you.
For your time, committee.
Our next claim is claims against the Department of Revenue, Carol Hallahan. Mr. Keeley, could you give us kind of a briefing before we get into that particular claim?
Mr. Chair, the claimant asked for $15,819 for past homestead and property tax credits. Claimant states she did not file these tax credits because of incorrect information she received from the Department of Revenue. Claimant states she received information 20-plus years ago and was not eligible, that she was not eligible for the credits because they only applied to homeowners who had unusually significant increases to property tax. This advice was not correct to the property tax fund that she now seeks to collect. I did briefly talk to our tax attorney in our office, and because that advice rang a bell, there is a property tax refund that is similar in structure to the one that she was given advice on. And you know, I think that the DNR, our revenue now that we're on, I think there's somebody here from revenue as well. So, but these were, they all, the revenue has a timeline on under which these lapse, and for these, the about 20 years worth of property taxes that she seeks now, the time for seeking those has lapsed on all of these claims.
Thank you, Mr. Keeley. Before we get too far, I'd just like to make the record clear that the bill, that the claim that we just have state that the $150,000 be taken from the DNR budget and transferred to the general fund. So just to make that clear for the record. Thank you, Mr. Keeley. For the record, we have testifier Ms. Helen. If you would recognize, give us your name, your full name, and please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
My full name is Carol Nancy Hallinan.
Please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it's he's already given basically my claim here. Just a little background. I moved here in 1991 with my three children, and okay. I bought a house in New Hope, and then I did my own taxes because I was just trying to save money. And the reason I called the government representative number that was listed on the tax refund form or booklet was because I had received a booklet and I was worried I had missed out on some refund and I was missing out, and so I called and the rep asked me multiple questions, and then she accessed like my taxes, and then that's when after that she told me what he already said. So unless I repeat, I can state it all, but that's pretty much so I've listed everything there, and I know Senator Ress said she would continue to try to have the statute amended for me, and the Department of Revenue actually recommended this committee to bring this to.
So, Ms. Helen, you said that Senator Rest encouraged you to come forward with your claim?
Senator Rest what?
Senator Rest encouraged you to bring forth your claim to the state?
And Senator Rest said she would continue to try to have the statute amended so I could submit my refund to the Department of Revenue and have them review it, and then base it on reviewing it and reviewing the adjusted gross income and the property taxes, and see if I would qualify for these refunds that I listed here, which I obtained off their website. I looked back in the years and went my adjusted gross income, and if it needed more. I sent copies of all my tax returns to the subcommittee claim, and I submitted copies of my property tax state amounts. And if it needed, I do have a copy of all my Social Security amounts of earnings.
Thank you, Ms. Helen. Could the Department of Revenue come forward? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Hainer. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The statute that Ms. Hallinan refers to is 289A, Minnesota Statute 289A.40, Subdivision 4, which specifically states that the department can only consider property tax refund claims going back a year from the original filing date of the return. So although Ms. Hallinan has not filed these claims with the Department of Revenue, that specific statute would prevent the Department of Revenue from refunding those amounts going back up to 20 years in some cases. I'd also like to mention that the property tax refund scheme has changed quite a bit over the years. Specifically, the main thing people will see is that the income limits have changed substantially. So 1 year you might not qualify for it, but the next year you may qualify for it. The department, I have no record, or the department has no record of this phone call ever occurring, but even if it did, like I just said, the income limits could change where 1 year she might not have qualified, but then the very next year she may have qualified. Based on the statute 289A.40 subdivision 4, as well as the fact of the changes over the years, the department respectfully requests that this committee deny the claim. Thank you.
Members, are there any questions for either the claimant or Mr. Hainer? Representative Murphy.
Ms. Hallinan, what happened? When I was reading this, I was wondering then what happened between 2007 and now? Did you file for your refund? Or I saw one thing in there for 2012, but do you?
I found out about this. That I had been given false information. I found out about it in 2015, so I did submit and file for 2013, which I did receive, 2013, 14, 15. There has never been a year when I would not qualify.
Representative Murphy.
Okay, so since you found out, you've been filing your claims. Mm-hmm. And so then you went back to the 2000 whatever year it was.
Yes, so I just went back through their site to go back.
Okay, thank you.
Further follow-up, Representative Murphy? Any further questions? No. Ms. Hallinan, you said that since 2007 to the present, to the 2015, that you found that you'd been given false information, and then you went back to 2013, 2014, and 2015 to submit an application for your
No, I was
refunds?
I was given false information 20 years ago when I called in.
In 2007?
It was probably around 1994, 95, yeah.
1994.
I remember the call very clearly, like it was just yesterday. I was nervous because I thought I had been missing out, and I thought I had missed out, and I thought I was missing out. So I called, and I was real clear. I don't make a lot of money. I have three children, and I was wondering if I would qualify for this because that number was listed on here. So I thought I was calling the government representative. And then that's when she said, well, let me check. And she asked me multiple questions. And then she accessed my records. And she said, no, absolutely not. You do not qualify for this. This is only for people that have had dramatic, huge increases in their property taxes, and they would just get back like a small portion. Don't worry about it. You didn't miss out on anything. You're not missing out on anything. This really doesn't even amount to much, basically. But that was false. That's never been the case, that it was just for people that had a huge percent increase, and they would just get back a small portion of that huge percent increase. Because I actually wrote to someone to find out if that was ever true, and that was never true. that it was just for huge increases. It's always been for based on income.
Thank you. Any questions for the claimant or for Mr. Hayner? Representative Murphy.
I do have one more question. Mr. Hayner, what is your response to someone that says that they were given false information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we take that very seriously at the Department of Revenue, but as I previously testified to, I have no way of knowing if this telephone call ever occurred, and if it did, what exactly was exchanged and said during that telephone call.
And, Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
what kind of records does the Department of Revenue keep on contacts made by citizens to their department?
Mr. Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, to the best of my knowledge, I don't really deal directly with taxpayers or work in that type of division, but to the best of my knowledge, I believe a lot of the phone calls are recorded now, and I do know that that they keep notes in our computerized system for more specific calls instead of the calls that come to, you know, the general helpline or something like that.
Representative Murphy.
That gives me comfort, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Especially in the last 6 months.
Okay. Mr. Keeley.
Mr. Chair, I do want to reiterate that there are multiple property tax refunds. There's the one that the claimant is claiming under right now. There's also one that is based on the increase, a percentage increase of what your property tax is. I don't want to get into any kind of speculation, but you know, there are multiple property tax refunds out there. And I did talk to our tax counsel today, and you know, again, the write-up, the description that claimant gives of the property tax advice she was given is for a property tax refund, not the one that she seeks to claim here.
Mr. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically it comes down to, for me, and my thought of what the committee can do is, one, there is no documentation to confirm that the conversation wasn't easily understood as being asking about one type of refund as opposed to another. Having done my own taxes for many years, I realize that there are frequently multiple different types of refunds, and it can be confusing and easily misunderstood in a conversation. But with that supposition that there was avenue for misunderstanding and the lack of having any documentation of what the actual conversation was, the length of over a couple of decades for this, I find it difficult to be able to go against the recommendation of the council and would move that we would deny as recommended by the staff council.
Representative Quam makes a motion that we take the recommendation of staff council that we deny the claim for Carol Helena. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, let's proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried.
Thank you, committee.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is my understanding, looking at the agenda, that we're on item number 6, and are there any testifiers on these four listed underneath item number 6?
Representative Cohen, looks like a lady is coming forward right now from probably the DOC or Human Services. If you'd state your name and proceed to identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jensina Rosen, and I work for Direct Care and Treatment Division with
the Minnesota. Could you say that a little slower and a little bit more direct into the?
Absolutely. My name is Jensina Rosen, and I am the claims specialist for the Department of Human Services Direct Care and Treatment Division.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please proceed with the claims that are Ms. Keenly, you got
I can summarize least a couple of the claims. There are four claims from the Department of Human Services. The first two are property claims, which the department has recommended denial, and I am in agreement on those denials. I don't know how much detail you would like to get into on what the claims are. I can briefly summarize. In the first claimant is claimant Fegaruz, who claims for $80.57 for a Blu-ray player, remote control, and batteries. The claimant received a Blu-ray and then was moved into a high-security area. His property was placed in the bins and zip-tied. The bins were not specifically inventoried. The zip-ties get a number. When the claimant was moved back out of the security area, he claimed the loss of the items. Staff followed up, and there was no record of the items.
Ms. Rosen, can you add anything to what Mr. Keenly had just stated?
Mr. Chair, I think he did a nice job summarizing that claim. We were no longer able to identify that he had that item in his possession when staff documented the items. So.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And noticing that the, I guess I would move that the first two Vigoros and Letcherwitz, but we take the recommendation from subcommittee counsel and deny those two claims.
Representative Quam makes the motion that we take the two claims against the Department of Human Services for Mr. Richard Fegaruz and Mr. Howard Lackowitzer and deny the claims. Discussion on that motion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is passed, and we have denied those two claims. Mr. Keeling.
I have next in my binder order the Jones claim, although next on the agenda I have the Pyron claim. I'm not sure what people have next.
I have the Pyron claim.
Okay.
You have the Jones claim. Oh, I do too.
Never okay, mind. We'll do the Jones claim then next. This claim is an injury claim. This happened at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. The claimant here asked for $600,000 for a knee injury. The claimant was attacked by another person in the facility, another patient. And he hit his knee against a wall, fracturing his lateral tibial plateau. The fracture was cast. The cast was removed, and the claimant had surgery for further repairs. The claimant was directed to be non-weight-bearing and given a wheelchair. Claimant was reported to be non-compliant with his non-weight-bearing requirements within 2 weeks of surgery. There were some complications. The claimant was actually, this happened in August, end of August of 2015. The claimant was discharged in December, so the paper trail sort of stopped there for a little while, and then he was readmitted in March of 2016, so about 3 months later. There were no records after his readmittance of any complications with this injury. There's no evidence given that there was any permanent partial disability. So I recommend denying the claim.
Ms. Rosen, any comments that you would like to add to that? The only question I would have on that claim was, it said that he had gotten x-rays, orthopedic consultations, surgeries, physical therapy, and medical out. In a personal, myself here, I had injury done to my shoulders, and I had x-rays done and had been recommended for going to therapy and things like that. It wasn't until after I had done all that and went back that I was recommended that I get an MRI. I'm just asking the question, why wasn't an MRI requested here for Mr. Jones in this case?
Mr. Chair, I do not have that information for you. The information that I have is in the file, so I don't have the specific information related to why he did not get an MRI at the time.
Thank you. I just curious because it happened to me. So we have a recommendation from the committee. Senator Ralph makes a motion that we move to deny the case on the claimant, Percy Jones. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in Representative Murphy. We're on Percy Jones.
Yes.
And are we
certain that he doesn't have
Ms. Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, it is my understanding that because he was a patient of Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the state covered all of his medical expenses, and so anything that he was requesting was compensatory above and beyond that. You're welcome.
Any further discussion on the motion to deny? Senator Ralph renews his motion that the claim for Percy Jones be denied as recommended by counsel. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried.
The next claim is the Pyron claim. This is a property claim. The claimant asked for $306.44 for the loss of a necklace. The claimant purchased a gold necklace from a jewelry company named Jewelry by Ponce. The claimant decided to return the necklace. This claimant is in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. MSOP procedures did not allow the client to pack his own items. The claimant brought the necklace to the property department to send back to Jewelry by Ponce. When it was packaged according to internal procedures, but when it reached Jewelry by Ponce, there was no necklace in it. The claimant pursued an insurance claim because he had purchased insurance through UPS on the package, and UPS came back denying that claim, saying that they were not responsible for the loss or damage to a package from improper packaging. That's a quotation from their denial. MSOP denies the claim, stating that there's no evidence to suggest that the MSOP property staff failed to follow policy, procedure, or were otherwise negligent. There's really no disagreement that MSOP were the last known holder of the necklace, and it appears both the claimant in submitting the necklace and the property division both followed the internal procedures of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program regarding this type of situation. It's one of the rare cases where we do know who last held the property, which is somewhat rare for this committee. So my recommendation is to hear it and then to see what further sort of rationale or explanation of the internal policies that aren't just what the paper policies are.
Ms. Rosen, can you add anything more to what Mr. Keenly just stated?
Yes, Mr. Chair. When the client, Mr. Pyron, brought the necklace to the centralized distribution area to be mailed out, he did so with a white envelope that it could be safely placed inside the mailer that MSOP staff would be mailing out. There are only certain types of mailers that clients are able to have access to in the facility for safety and security purposes, and they cannot package and mail items on their own. So they have to bring it to staff, and staff have to package that item up. So he did bring it there. Staff did put the necklace inside the envelope and put it in the mailer, and then they sealed that up in front of the presence of other staff. This claimant has had multiple claims in the past, so I think that property staff were taking extra precautions to make sure that this item was handled appropriately, and then they did mail it out, and it wasn't until that item made it back to the vendor that the vendor opened it and said the necklace was not in there.
Senator Ralph.
Is there any, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, is it Jessica?
It's Jensina.
Jensia. Yeah. Rosen. Ms. Rosen. So it's clear that the MSOP was the final custodian of the necklace before it was sent, and that the packaging, you say they were very careful about it, so obviously the package was properly prepared in from what you've been able to find. I guess I'm concerned that if you take custody of something and then you take the responsibility to mail it, that you're the one that's going to be liable if it doesn't make it to where it goes. Now, that may be, and I'm not quite sure why UPS denied the claim, which is what troubles me about this. We don't know how the necklace was lost. Unfortunately, the MSOP took custody of it, and that's the concern that I have. Now, had Mr. Pyron mailed it and it had not gotten there, obviously that was his problem. But I am concerned that this was something that did actually come from the department, no matter how carefully they did attempt to take care of it. So that would be my concern. And if there's no further information, has anything been done to follow up with UPS or on this,
Mr. Ralph,
other than the insurance claim?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ralph, it's my understanding that was insurance that the client had purchased himself, and UPS had denied the claim based on the type of packaging. They said that the type of packaging wouldn't have been appropriate for the item that he was mailing, and so that is why UPS denied the claim. In my reading of the Tort Claims Act, it's my understanding that the state of Minnesota, when exercising or completing a duty in the role of their responsibility as an employee or employer, they're not responsible for lost, damaged, or stolen property. And so in my estimation, because our staff were following our policies and procedures, if the item was lost, the state of Minnesota still wouldn't be responsible for that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know on Department of Corrections, we have very well-defined limits of what the liability is for a shoe, a TV, etc. Are there any guidelines that set limits to what a ring or jewelry or necklace would be in this situation?
Mr. Keenly?
Sorry, I missed that whole thing. But just to restate for the record with my mic on, it appears that there's some differences between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services with what type of jewelry is allowable to be had. There doesn't seem to be any claim that the claimant in this case improperly had the jewelry. For whatever purpose, it had come in, and we know what the value on this was because he had just purchased it and was sending it back. whether we want to, it's certainly within the subcommittee's jurisdiction to determine whatever award they deem appropriate. The way that the total was come to was the $300 for the necklace plus the $644 for the insurance that the claimant purchased, the UPS insurance that the claimant had purchased on the necklace.
Representative Quorum, follow up. Mr. Chair, I don't see that the insurance would be a component of anything we would determine. I'm used to there being a limit of X amount in other situations, and if there's not a limit, then I'll defer to the other members of what they are thinking on this issue.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the MSOP is responsible because they limit the kind of packaging the persons have access to. The clients have only certain kinds of packaging that they have access to, and if that's not enough to provide safety for an item to get to where it's supposed to get, it sure isn't the client's fault, and obviously the UPS is saying it's not their fault, and so the only ones whose fault it is then is the people that didn't provide the proper packaging and had limits to what kind of bags they had to use. And no matter how careful they were to put it into what they had, it must not have been proper.
Representative Murphy, would you like to make a motion?
I move that we pay it, that MSOP pays it.
Representative Murphy makes a motion that the claim for Alan Pyron on loss of jewelry,
he thought he was
that it be paid at the requested amount of $306.44, and that money be taken from the MSOP and put in the general fund. Senator Ralph.
I would have to agree with Representative Quam that the value of the jewelry should be replaced, but I'm not so sure about the insurance. That was his. And unfortunately, it didn't work. In that case, I'm not sure that the fact that the insurance didn't cover it was the fault of the agency. So I would tend to agree with that.
Senator, Mr. Keenly.
I believe in property claims, we typically don't appropriate those. We just have the department work that comes out of the department. I will check with on historical on that. But that typically property claims come out of that we just direct the department to work with to pay that. We don't put it into the claims bill itself.
Okay. Then the motions before us then is to pay the claim for the Alan Pyron case. Further discussion? No further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. The case for Alan Pyron is passed, and we will move on. The next order of business is number 7 on our agenda. And that agenda is for medical reimbursement to the Department of Corrections for injury claims. Mr. Keenly, if you'd help us out with that.
These are claims that the Department of Corrections has authority to go through a process to pay for sentence to service and community work service. As of last year, the claim limit on these were raised to $7,000. It looks like there are 4 claims that come under this this year, totaling $965 for approval to be put into the claims bill.
Thank you, Mr. Keenly. I see we have someone from the Department of Corrections. If you could state your name for the record and testify on the claims of Mr. Adams, DePoe, Kensler, and Tchaikovsky.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Jean Whitney. I'm Associate General Counsel for the Department of Corrections.
speak up a little bit? My hearing either is gone or is it too late in the night? Okay.
My name is Jean Whitney.
Now I didn't hear that.
Yeah. My name is Jean Whitney. I'm Associate General Counsel for the Department of Corrections.
Thank you.
And the claims that you're referring to are claims that were submitted by either medical providers or the offenders who were working in our community work service or sentence to service program, and they sustained injuries there. The statute allows for us to reimburse up to $7,000 now, but we did way better and only gave you $965 for those four claims.
Members, are there any questions of Ms. Whitney or regarding the claims that are before us? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, noticing that in this section there are multiple ones of which the department and the council recommend paying. And so I would move that we follow the recommendations for this section. It's what? One is Erlinson, two Berg.
Mr. Chair. Oh, we're on the wrong section here. It's number seven on our list of claims, medical reimbursement of Department of Corrections.
Oh.
Mr. Keenley, can you just address that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We're on item seven. This will be procedural, and then we'll get to the...
Right. So could I have a motion to, or any discussion on those claims on one, two, three, and four?
Also move.
Senator Ralph moves that we accept the recommendations of counsel on the claims for injury claims, Department of Corrections on one, Adams, two, DePoe, three, Kensler, and four, Shakowski. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Those claims have been accepted, and we'll move on to the claims against the Department of Corrections. And again, that's number eight on your agenda, and we have before us another testifier, Ms. Whitney. And Ms. Keenley, if you want to give us a brief before that.
Yeah, we can move, Mr. Chair, we can move quickly through at least this first one. I think this is a holdover from both 2 years ago and then last year. There was a request by the committee to get more information regarding whether the claimant had a permanent partial disability. The claimant has not provided any evidence in the 2 years subsequent to the original hearing of this. So I think that there's probably, at this point, the department recommends closing the claim at this point, and I'm in agreement with denying it.
Ms. Whitney, any comments of what Mr. Keenley have just stated?
Mr. Chair, no, I have no additional comments.
Okay, then can I have a recommendation for the claimant on Mr. Erlinson? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Whitney, do you have any information on what Mr. Erlinson says?
Mr. Chair? Representative Murphy?
Ms. Whitney.
We sent two letters to Mr. Erlinson. He never responded.
The Erlinson case? Representative Murphy moves that we close the injury claim on Mr. Nathan Erlinson. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion to close the case on Nathan Erlinson signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The motion is passed, and the case is closed on Mr. Erlinson. Mr. Keenley.
The next claim is the Berg claim. Mr. Berg asked for compensation for injuries to two fingers. The claimant injured the two fingers when a food service window fell on his hand. Medical staff splinted his hand after the injury. X-rays taken the following day showed a compound fraction of his right ring finger and a non-displaced fracture of his right middle finger. Claimant's fingers were surgically pinned. Claimant's middle finger fully healed. However, his ring finger lost some active range of motion. Claimant's ring finger injury is permanent. DOC recommends a rating of 30% of the ring finger being 5% of the whole body is a total of 1.5% of the whole body, or a permanent partial disability payment of $1,125. I agree with that recommendation.
Any further discussion? Or Ms. Whitney, if you'd like to comment?
Mr. Chair, I have no other comments.
Okay. Members, any comments on the claim from Mr. Philip Berg? Representative Murphy moves that we recommend to pay for the Philip Berg claim on his fingers being disabled, partial disability. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Mr. Keeling.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Bird claim. Mr. Bird, claimant Bird, asked for $9,350 for a severed index finger. Claimant's right index finger was cut off while he was operating a plasma cutter. After meeting with a hand specialist, claimant opted not to attempt reattachment. The Department of Corrections recommends, and I agree with, that the claimant's loss of finger is permanent and equals an 11% rating of the whole body, which is a partial permanent disability payment of $9,350.
Ms. Whitney, any comments to that claim?
Mr. Chair, I have no other comments.
Members of the committee, any comments? Senator Quam? Representative Quam.
I move that we pay.
Representative Quam moves that we pay the claim for Mr. Kurt Bird for the loss of his finger, the partial permanent disability payment of $9,350. Any further questions? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Same thing. No. Claim is agreed on. Thank you. Ms. Kinley?
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Braylock claim. I think that Mr. Braylock is represented by counsel. Not here. Okay. Mr. Braylock is not represented by counsel. At the, Mr. Braylock asked for $1 million for lung damage. Claimant complained of a chronic cough. Claimant was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Claimant worked in the industry shops for nearly 10 years. The claimant links his work to the industry shops with his COPD. Claimant had respiratory tests done as part of his diagnosis and treatment, and the results of these tests fall within the range of no disability. There's insufficient evidence generating a partial permanent disability rating, and the department recommends, and I'm in agreement with it, without further evidence, there is to deny this claim.
Members, any further comments or questions or concerns, or do we have a motion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to deny.
Representative Quam moves to deny the claim by Mr. Ben Braylock regarding damage to his lungs based on no evidence found by the department. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote on the motion. Say everyone in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Claim is denied.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Bryson claim. Mr. Bryson asked for $7,500 for a middle finger injury. Claimant suffered an avulsion to his left middle finger while using a brake press in the machine shop. After 4 weeks of checkup, healing was progressing well enough to not schedule any more follow-ups. There's insufficient evidence of an injury generating a partial permanent disability rating. Both the department's and my recommendation is to deny.
The motion before, the claim before it is on Mr. Raphael Bryson. Any comments or questions or a motion to accept or deny? Senator Ralph. Senator Ralph moves to deny the claim for Mr. Raphael Bryson, who's asking for $7,500 for a middle finger injury, but because of lack of insufficient evidence, there's moved to deny. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion to deny the claim, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries, and the claim is denied. Mr. Keeling?
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Cantu claim. Mr. Cantu asked for $600,000 for an injury to his ankle. On May 20th, 2014, claimant was working in a facility kitchen when his lower leg was burned by steam. He was admitted to Regent's Hospital burn unit and received a skin graft. After months of follow-up appointments and physical therapy, medical professionals determined claimant had maximized his medical treatment overall for the skin burn. In early 2017, the claimant was assessed by Dr. Wilson using the workers' comp schedule. Dr. Wilson identified three conditions: limited range of motion in his ankle, cold intolerance, and sensory loss. The DOC agrees in full with the doctor's range of motion determination. The DOC does not support the cold intolerance claim, and the DOC agrees with a claim of partial sensory loss, not the full sensory loss that was in the doctor's calculation. I agree with the department's determination on the range of motion and the sensory loss issues. The only mention of the cold intolerance in the claim is in Dr. Wilson's rating determination. There's no additional evidence in Dr. Wilson's documentation regarding the cold intolerance. Without the cold intolerance, the claimant's permanent injury equates a 4.48 rating. If you include the cold intolerance claim, it would be a 7.36 rating.
Members, are there any questions about this claim for Mr. Cantu? Mr. Representative Murphy.
So what's the amount?
If there's also $370 worth of medical expenses to be paid. So without the cold intolerance claim, the total would be $3,729.79, and with the cold intolerance claim, it would be $6,257.79.
Representative Murphy.
It seems to me from previous cases, Ms. Whitney, from other years, sometimes it takes a while to find out if they have that intolerance.
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, this offender was released, I believe it was sometime in 2016. He's now been evaluated by a doctor in Texas whose recommendation is what we got. The problem that I had with the information from the doctor was that he didn't provide any information to support the claim about intolerance. And so we have no way to base that. We have no way to to say that that's true. We sent him the schedules, the disability schedules. He wasn't familiar with those. He looked at the schedules, and that was his reading of them. So,
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, if he's living in Texas, I suppose he doesn't. It's warmer down there, so it wouldn't be so regular. Cold access to cold. So, okay, I'll go with the 37. Was it
$3,700? $29. Representative Murphy, are you making that a motion?
Okay.
Okay, Representative Murphy is making a motion that we pay a partial claim for Mr. Eloy Cantu of $3,729.79. Is there any further discussion on the claim? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of Representative Murphy's claim to pay the claimant, Mr. Eloy Cantu, $3,729.79, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried. The claim is paid. Mr. Keenly.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Comstock claim. Claimant Comstock asked for reimbursement for his medical expenses. Claimant stepped off a step stool while working in the welding shop. He dislocated his shoulder, chipped a bone in his elbow, and injured his back and neck. 2 months later, claimant was released on supervised release. While on supervised release, he sought treatment for his injuries at United Hospital District. When the Department of Corrections contacted the hospital billing department to fulfill this claim, they were notified that claimant had died from other causes. So there's no showing of any partial permanent injury, but the medical expenses reimbursed at the MA rates equal $4,209.30.
Members, are there any further questions or comments about the claim for Mr. James Comstock. Do I have a motion? Senator Ralph moves that we take council's recommendation to pay $4,209.30 to a United Hospital District for Mr. James Comstock's hospital bills that he had ran up there. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion is carried and the claim has been paid. Mr. Keenley.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the CAM claim. Mr. CAM asked for $10,000 for a soft tissue injury to his right thumb. Claimant's right thumb was injured while he was operating a router in the wood shop. Claimant lost one-third of the soft tissue of his right thumb tip. Medical records showed that his thumb otherwise healed well. Claimant's injury is consistent with an isolated loss of soft tissue at the end of the thumb under the workers' compensation scale. I agree with the DOC's determination that the injury is permanent and equates a 5% rating in the whole body, equaling a partial permanent disability payment of $3,750.
Members, are there any questions or concerns or comments about this claim for Joseph Cam, or is there a motion? Representative Quam.
Thank you. I'm noticing there's a PPD notation on several of the ones in this section. Does that mean that it's already that amount has already been paid?
Mr. Keenley?
Is this on the, Mr. Chair, on the spreadsheet?
It's on the spreadsheet, Mr. Keenley.
Oh, I see. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes, it's PPD for permanent partial disability.
Thank you, Mr. Keenley. Representative Quam, do you have a motion?
I'd move to agree with Council's recommendation and make the payment for the $3,750.
Any further discussion? Motion is before us that recommended by Council and by Representative Quam that we pay the Joseph Cam claim for partial permanent disability payment of $3,750. Any further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion is carried. Mr. Keenley.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Carnes claim. Claimant Carnes asked for $100,000 for a broken ankle and lost future wages. Claimant slipped on a wet floor and broke a bone in his left ankle. Claimant had surgery to repair the ankle, and claimant's ankle healed well, but he did lose some range of motion. Claimant's ankle injury is permanent. The DOC recommends a 4% rating of the whole body, equaling a partial permanent disability rating of $3,000. I agree with that recommendation. I also agree with the DOC's recommendation to deny payment based on loss of future income. There is no documentation provided about any loss of income.
Thank you, Mr. Keenley. Any questions or comments on the statements made by Mr. Keenley and also the recommendations made by the department on the Carnes claim? If not, can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Representative Murphy moves that the claim for Clinton Carnes be paid at a equaling a partial permanent disability payment of $3,000 and that it be paid by the department. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say sign. Motion is carried. The claim is passed. Mr. Keenley.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Keith claim. Claimant Keith asked for compensation for shoulder pain. Claimant fell on January 26, 2015, scraping his shin and bruising his ankle. He also reported several upper body injuries resulting from attempting to break his fall. Claimant had continued pain in his right shoulder. Claimant also has a neck diagnosis that often generates shoulder pain, including degenerative joint disease and a cervical spine nerve and some cervical spine nerve issues. Claimant's shoulder pain level is variable throughout his medical history, with limited active range of motion limitations occurring only at times of high pain. Claimant has been prescribed pain medication and physical therapy consistent with his medical conditions. There's insufficient evidence that there's an injury that generates a partial permanent disability. There's also questions of whether all with the number of different issues, non-fall related, what might be going on here. The department and I are in agreement with denying this claim.
Ms. Whitney, any comments on the Keith claim?
Mr. Chair, I have no additional comments on that one.
Okay. Members, do you have any comments or questions? Or can we have a motion on the Keith claim? Senator Ralph moves that we take the recommendation by counsel and DOC that we deny the claim for Leslie Keith. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The claim has been denied. Mr. Keenly.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Knudsen claim. Mr. Knudsen asked for $10,000 for the amputation of the distal tip of his left ring finger. The tip of claimant's left ring finger was pinched between a log and a steel plate of a wood splitter. Claimant was taken to the hospital where they amputated the distal tip of the finger. DOC recommends payment of $750 based on a permanent partial disability of 1% of the body. I agree with this payment consistent with the amputation of the distal phalanx of the ring finger to the middle of the phalanx.
Members, any questions or comments on the Knudsen claim? Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Representative Murphy moves that we pay the...
$750.
Correct. That we move the recommendation of council and DOC recommends payment of $750 permanent partial disability for Mark Knudsen. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Claim has been paid. Mr. Keenly.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Long claim. Claimant Long asked for $20,000 for loss of movement and feeling in his arm. Claimant fractured his humerus while he tripped at work. The fracture was cast. After the casters were removed, claimant began physical therapy. Claimant made consistent progress with strength and range of motion. Physical therapist noted claimant had regained full range of motion, and the most recent physical therapy record in his file showed him bench pressing 50 pounds. There's insufficient evidence that this injury generated a partial permanent disability. Denial is recommended.
Recommendation by counsel to deny the claim for Mr. Napoleon Long. Ms. Whitney, any comments?
No comments.
The recommendation is there a motion? Representative Quam.
So moved.
Representative Quam moves that we deny the claim for Napoleon Long regarding a partial permanent disability. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The motion is carried. The claim has been denied. Mr. Keenly.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Rosendahl claim, and I believe Mr. Rosendahl is represented by counsel. The claimant asked for $33,303.45 for the amputation of his thumb tip. Claimant's left thumb was amputated on a table saw in the carpentry shop. The thumb tip was recovered and reattachment was attempted. Medical records showed that after reattachment, the amputated bone healed, but the tissue surrounding the bone died. The thumb bone was then surgically shortened. It's unclear from the medical records whether the bone was surgically amputated at the same spot of the original amputation. The DOC recommends a permanent partial disability rating based on a 6.5 rating for an amputation of a thumb of less than half of the distal phalanx. This would equate to a payment of $5,525. Claimant asked for award based on the amputation of more than half of the distal phalanx, which is an 11% rating, or $9,350. Based on the images of the thumb, which I think you all have, it looks like approximately half to me. So whether we do greater than a half or less than a half, based on the importance of the thumb and it being right, looking like it's on the border, I think it might make sense to resolve this at the higher level, but I'll certainly leave that up to the subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Keenly. Ma'am, if you would identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony on the Colton Rosendahl claim.
Yes, my name is Ashley Raso, R-A-S-O,
filling in for my colleague, Ms. Simpson, representing Colton Rosenthal. And I mean, I would hate to I would if we want to take that recommendation, I don't say anything. you know, I've learned a lot about hands in the last few days for a generally a products liability attorney, but I would just point to the operative report. Specifically, the doctor says the amputation went just distal to the IP joint of the thumb and was complete. I've done some research on what the distal part of the IP joint is, and that is just at the joint of the phalange. So my recommendation, or my my argument would be that does qualify for the 11%. And I do have graphs and stuff if you want them.
No, ma'am, your last name was what?
Raso, R-A-S-O. My first name is Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H.
Ms. Raso, how was your client today?
You know, the report did talk a little bit about that nail growing back, and although it has sort of grown back, that's not a positive for this land. It's not, it obviously doesn't look like a good nail or a real nail. It's more kind of draws attention to the deformity. You know, the nail after the amputation has healed well, but like I said, the deformity is still there with the half a nail hanging on, and obviously the thumb, you know, being an important appendage.
Members, any questions for Ms. Raso? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move for the subcommittee council's recommendation of paying $9,350.
Representative Quam makes a motion that we pay the recommendation from council to the claimant of 11% rating for a $9,350 award. Are there any further comments or questions? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Claim is paid at $9,354 for the Colton Rosendahl claim. Thank you, Ms. Raso.
Thank you,
Mr. Keenly.
Mr. Chair, the next claim is the Stengel claim. I sent an updated memo on this. My original recommendation, claimant Stengel asked for compensation for a forehead scar. The claimant was struck in the head by a tray in the kitchen, causing a cut to his forehead. Claimant received stitches, which were removed approximately 1 week later. No additional treatment was required. Originally, I thought that this, based on the schedule, was just under the minimum in order for it to be compensated or to be on the compensation schedule. It apparently is right at the minimum of 2 centimeters. But for cosmetic scars, there's a 2-year waiting period from when the injury occurred, and that has not yet passed in this situation. So we can either... Granting it is not within the schedule, so we can either hold it over for another year or, you know, like I said, it does just meet the minimum of a scar, and I know that there's been some discussion previously about, you know, what level of compensation the state should give for cosmetic deformities. I believe there are colored pictures. There's a color picture in your packet. So at this point, the options on the table are either to deny the claim outright or to hold it for next session.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Noticing that there's no amount indicated on the claim amount, I don't think that I am okay with allowing it to hold over. You know, with the latest recommendation.
Any further questions on Stacey Stengel claim? Since we can't go ahead and approve it, Any other comments or questions? Sounds like Representative Quam is maybe making a motion to lay it over for future hearing. Do you want to make that a permanent motion?
Yes.
Oh, Senator Quam, Representative Quam makes a motion that we hold over the Stacey Stengel case for the next claims, Joint House Senate Subcommittee Claims Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The Stacey Stengel claim is being held over for next claims committee hearing. Mr. Kenley.
Mr. Chair, this is the last of the injury claims. So Mr. Taylor asked for $9,500 for cutting his index finger on a table saw. Claimant cut his finger while working in the wood shop. He was taken to health services where his cut was treated with Steristrips and dressed. Claimant had 4 follow-up visits. There are no pain or problems reported. There's insufficient evidence in this claim to generate a partial permanent disability rating. Denial is recommended.
Is there a motion on the last claim, Demetrius Taylor? Representative Smith moves to deny the claim for Demetrius Taylor. Further discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion to deny the Demetrius Taylor claim signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The claim is denied. Ms. Kinley, Mr. Kinley.
We now have in front of us the property claims. In working with the Department of Corrections, one claim got pulled that the Department of Corrections is working currently on making an offer to the claimant. In all other instances, both the Department of Corrections and my recommendation are to deny, but I'm certainly happy to take a look at any claims and go into more detail with any claims that you would like to take a deeper look at.
Senator, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would make a motion that we accept the recommendation of the council for the remaining claims on the agenda.
Representative Quam makes a motion that we accept the recommendation by our claims committee council, Mr. Kinley. To deny all the property claimants from 1 Mr. through 56. Any further comments or questions? Senator Ralph.
Well, being new to this committee, I do have a question for the Department of Corrections. It seems in these property claims that there are some rules in terms of property, damaged property, and treating that as contraband and then disposing of it. Just a brief discussion about that. It seems to me somewhat cavalier to simply dispose of something of somebody's property because it's broken, and I'm not quite sure I follow that. I'm sure there's a very good reason, and I assume you can explain that to me.
Ms. Whitney?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ralph, there is a very good reason, although I too have some questions about how that rule is implemented. But if you, generally speaking, damaged means cracked or broken in some way. And what happens with all of these, mostly it's electronic items. So once a TV, which is made of clear plastic, has a crack, a piece can be taken out and used to sharpen and be a weapon. And if you ever want to go on a tour of any of our facilities, we have cases that show the creative uses of broken items, toothbrushes, TV parts, radio parts. So that's really why. Sometimes things are confiscated that I've questioned, and in fact we had one that we just recently made an offer to pay because the staff said it wasn't working, and we thought, well, it wasn't working. I said, why not? Why? What was wrong with it? Well, there was a line across the screen, and I said, when I first watched TV, there were lines across the screen all the time, and I watched TV just fine. So we're working on clarifying what working or broken or altered means, but that's generally the reason.
Senator Rell, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that answers my question.
Any further discussion on the motion that's before us to deny the next 56 claims? Mr. Keenly.
I think we should, the number six on that claim list is the one that the department is currently working on making an offer, so we should leave that out of this because we don't want to necessarily deny it when there's a offer on the table.
Mr. Qualm?
I take that as a friendly, clarifying technical amendment,
okay,
not requiring a vote.
So, members, the motion before us less the number six on our line items of the claim, property claimants to deny all those claims except number six. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion to deny has been approved, and we are at the end of our agenda for tonight. Thank you, members. Any further comments, Mr. Keenly?
No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Murphy?
No shoes at all.
There are some shoes that have been lost, but we're working on making sure that they keep track of their shoes better.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see... Oh, I'm sorry.